Hi, you're listening to the weekly podcast of Life Ministry Church. For more information, head to our website, www.lmc.org.au.
And good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming back. I was impressed when people come back for more. That's amazing. So I just need to make sure I've got the right talk here, which I haven't by some remarkable circumstance. So just give me a moment while I get sorted. Okay, so do we have an image? All right. So this morning, I was able to just quickly lay some foundations, the kind of big picture. But there's a lot of talk about how we can explain away what I think is the obvious evidence for a creator. And the way people do it is with a lot of kind of arm waving, and they say, well, things look designed, but design is really just a kind of apparition, if you like, that we can explain complex systems through time and chance. But I want to just talk about this subject then divine design, cosmic accident or divine design. I get the title right. And so if you were walking along a beach somewhere and you came across a scatter of pebbles in the sand, you wouldn't be particularly surprised. It's just the random action of the waves and wind and sand and pebbles and so on. But if you saw this in the sand, what would you think? Now, you pretty obviously know that that's not the result of an accidental process. I mean, intuitively you can tell somebody has intervened in that. How do you know? What is it that gives away something's been designed? There's been an external agent which has acted on the stones. Well, one of the things is that it's a very improbable arrangement of pebbles, but probability alone doesn't get you there. Most importantly, though, it complies with a predetermined code. So a circle, two dots for eyes, nose, mouth, that's a symbol of a face. And there's nothing in pebbles and sand that will just naturally produce faces. If that was true, when you walk around, all these little faces would be looking at you. But that's not what happens, is it? So there's a predetermined code here. What about in the discipline of archaeology? The archaeologist looks at an object like this figurine. Now, he knows that stones don't normally come in that kind of shape. There's clearly been some kind of action on the stone to shape it like this figurine. But then we look at a vase of flowers, and we look at the vase, and we know that that clearly was made. I mean, silicon dioxide and sand doesn't normally shape itself like vases, right? So we know that was made, and yet the flowers, which are vastly more complex, we're told happened by accident. So it's a crazy kind of world. And so I want to look at this topic, cosmic accident or divine design. That thing, by the way, is a glass-winged butterfly. Isn't that astonishing? I mean, what sheer brilliance. I look at that and I just give praise to an amazingly creative designer God. They don't need to be transparent wings for the creature to fly, but there we are. Now, the Bible tells us that we are to demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. And I believe that belief in evolution is probably the greatest pretension that stops people from coming to know God. And I say that because in Hebrews 11:6 it says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. Right? Anyone who comes to God must believe what? That he is, that he exists. How can you come to a God if you don't even believe he exists? So what evolution does is it persuades people that there is no God, the universe made itself by accident, and we can explain it all. So it really is a very significant barrier to people coming to faith. Now, we're often told that the evidence for The evolutionary story is self-evident. You can just see it there. But here's an interesting quotation from Stephen Jay Gould, who sums up this topic well. He says, "Facts do not speak for themselves. They're read in the light of theory, in other words, preconceived ideas. Creative thought in science, as much as in the arts, is the motor of changing opinion. Science is a quintessentially human activity, not a mechanized, robot-like accumulation of objective information leading by laws of logic to inescapable interpretation." But the latter is the image that we have of the scientist in the lab coat. Doesn't make mistakes, makes observations, logical deductions, reaches conclusions. It's all a done deal. But he gives away the game, doesn't he? Because the facts don't speak, they are always interpreted. In Time magazine some years ago, the headline was God versus Science. And it's often presented as a debate between science and faith. But I want to suggest to you it actually is not about science versus faith at all. And let me appeal to Richard Lewontin, a very high-profile evolutionist, who says, "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism." Now, he doesn't mean the love of possessions in this. He means the belief that the universe consists only of matter and energy. It's all molecules and electrons and stuff, nothing else. That's all there is. And he goes on and says, "Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." Now, I'd suggest to you he's just given away his religion. So what he's actually talking about is not science versus faith, but it's actually the conflict of two different faiths. And as I said this morning, one faith begins with the assumption there is no God, and we build this whole explanatory framework based on that. Atheism dressed up in a lab coat, remember? And the other side, we have there is a God who's the creator of the universe and who has revealed himself to us in his word. The other thing which... So, science and interpretations of origins are based on faith. It's always faith. By the way, we can't prove the Bible with science either, and nor do we attempt to do that. If we were, it would be like elevating science above God's word and making it the benchmark and testing the scriptures against science. But it's not like that. The Bible, as God's word, is our source of revealed truth, and we use its historical record as the framework to interpret the world around us. But people tend to define away the whole possibility of a supernatural creator. This guy, Scott Todd, said, "Even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such an hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic." So you notice what he's done here. He's slipped in another definition. Science is actually the study of the physical universe to discover how things work. It says nothing about whether you can only come up with naturalistic or supernaturalistic explanations. So let's apply that philosophy. And imagine you were exploring South Dakota and you came across the president's heads at Mount Rushmore. Now, you can only appeal to naturalistic explanations, right? They're the rules of science. So we have to look at that and think, my goodness, isn't it astonishing what wind and sand erosion has done on these mountains? It's remarkable. I mean, what ridiculous nonsense is that? At the moment you look at that, you know perfectly well there has been an external hand at work. And the artist took some 14 years, in fact, to construct that. Clearly an external agency. So I worked in the satellite communications field and was involved in the design of all of Australia's national satellites. The Optus C1 was one of those that I worked on. And it's obviously designed. If you told me that the satellite got into orbit and functions all by accident, I'd be a little bit miffed, along with many hundreds of other engineers and scientists who worked on the project. And yet, we're told that something as complex as the monarch butterfly arose by chance, and it is vastly more complex than a communications satellite. So what evidence is there for design? How do we recognise design? Well, I want to look at three aspects of design this afternoon. The first one is, in something designed, there is always evidence of information, which you can think of as a specified complexity. So when you're constructing a spacecraft, the design is translated into assembly instructions in the factory that produces the commercial satellite, and they are faithfully followed. Every stage is tested. The final assembly is done prior to the launch. I had a particular interest in the antenna assembly on those spacecraft. That was where my postgrad research was focused. And as you can see, this contraption is not exactly a random accident, though it looks a bit like it. It's actually an extraordinarily complex system on board the spacecraft. So what is information? There are all sorts of definitions. I won't bore you with those, but let me give you an example of information transmission. Let's say I want to communicate something from me to you. So a thought arises in my mind and I want to transmit it. How do I do that? Well, the first thing I do is I encode it, and in this case, into words and also into images. And when I encode my thought, I have to use a predetermined set of rules, grammar, English, and you can understand me. I hope you can anyway, because you probably speak English too. But if I were up here speaking in Swahili, I reckon no one would know what I was talking about. Okay, so I've formulated and encoded my information. Then I transmit it to you. At the moment, it's coming by sound. And you receive the information, and luckily, you have a decoding system which uses the same rules of grammar and pronunciation and spelling. And so you decode the information and it arises in your mind. Now, if that communication path actually worked, with a bit of luck, what arose in my mind and what's now arising in yours are one and the same. Now, there's lots of ways in which that can get confused. And we all know good examples of miscommunication. But as I've mentioned, a predetermined code's necessary. Let's say you saw these four letters. Now, that would conjure up in your mind what? What do you think of when you see those letters? Yeah, something like that, some kind of a gift. Now, you think that because you speak English. But what if you spoke German? Any German speakers? What does G-I-F-T mean in German? Anyone? It means poison. Now, German postal workers, after the Second World War, were very nervous about handling parcels from England that said gift. Until someone explained, it's okay. What about these four letters, C-H-A-T? That conjures up in my mind an informal conversation over a cup of coffee, right? What if you were French? What does C-H-A-T mean in French? Anyone? It's a cat, that's right. So if you don't have the right code in your head, you're not going to be able to communicate, right? But how do you get this predetermined code? See, I can't give you a kilogram of English. It's not matter. So the universe consists of more than just matter and energy. Information is a vital part of this universe. Now, can information arise by chance? Now, this is the challenge that the evolutionist has, because the evolutionist limits themselves to naturalistic explanations. They have to explain the presence of information through random accidental processes. You cannot have a guiding intelligence, because if you do, you've just got God, all right? So imagine you're having a plate of alphabet soup and you dip your spoon in and up it comes and that's what you see. Now, what do you reckon's the chance of that? That's not going to happen, is it? Just for those of you who are mathematically inclined, the probability of that is something like 1 part in 10 to the 18th, which is a staggeringly small number. In fact, it's the equivalent of guessing an 18-digit PIN in one shot without making a mistake. I mean, how impossible is that? So information simply doesn't come about by chance, but information is everywhere. Information specifies living things. If I wanted to make this single-celled bacterium, I could write out all the instructions for assembling the bits to make it. It would occupy something like a 500-page book, pretty sizable. But if I wanted to make something a lot more complex than a single-celled bacterium, like a horse, now I need piles more books of information. Information about making muscles, bones, eyes, heart, lungs, hair, you know, the list goes on and on and on. Now, for the evolutionist, he has to be able to explain how the single-celled bacterium gets all the way up to complex organisms like horses by chance. So all that added information, those piles of books, have to happen randomly and by chance. Remember that spoonful? Are you happy? Chance of that happening is basically zero. How are you going to get all those encyclopedia-sized volumes of information? Now, all those instructions are stored on this incredible molecule, the DNA molecule, and it's the most efficient information storage system in the universe. Human DNA contains enough information to fill about 1,000 encyclopedia-sized books. Now, when I'm talking to youth groups, I have to explain what an encyclopedia is, because they've got no idea. So I say, it's like a printed version of Wikipedia. Then they get it. So what are the mechanisms that the evolutionist proposes by which information is gained to go from simple to complex? Increasing genetic information. Well, the first one was natural selection. This is what Darwin supposed was the mechanism from going from simple to complex. And if you have enough selection, enough changes, then if it changes enough, you can go from a bacterium to a whatever, a biologist. So let's talk a bit about how natural selection works. Now, you need to have good imaginations. So let's imagine that these two little creatures are medium-length haired dogs, right? Big step, but just come with me. Now, if we breed these two dogs, then there's a number of ways that we can get their offspring. This first guy, he gets a short-haired gene. I should just back up a minute. They're medium-length haired dogs because they have a gene, a short-haired and a long-haired gene each. And if they're codominant, then they will have medium-length hair. So the first little puppy, he gets the short-haired gene from both of his parents. So he's a very, very short-haired dog. The next two, a bit like their parents, they get a long and a short from each of their parents, so they've got medium-length hair. But this little guy gets the jackpot, and he gets the long-haired gene from each of his parents, so he's a very hairy little dog, right? Now, let's say this population of dogs migrates to a cold country with lots of ice and snow and sleet. The ones with short and medium-length hair will be selected against by the environment because they're just too cold to survive. But the long-haired ones will be fine. Now, let's imagine these two fall in love, produce a bunch of puppies. Every single one of the puppies will have, guess what? Long hair. But why? Because the genetic information in the parents is only for long hair. So what's actually happened is in that population of dogs, there's been a loss of genetic information for making medium and short-haired dogs. All they can ever produce a long head. Now, if that population of dogs then moves to a very hot country, they're not going to survive because they'll overheat. But there's no genetic information that will permit them to back up and produce short-haired dogs. It's been lost from the population. So the important conclusion is that natural selection reduces information. But wait a minute. To go from simple to complex, you need to add information. Natural selection works the wrong way. It goes downhill, but the evolutionist needs an uphill process. So just observation of what we see in the world around us argues directly against the whole idea of simple to complex through random processes. Now, even professional biologists don't get this, believe it or not. I want to share a short video clip with you featuring Dr. David Catchpole, who was a biologist, a PhD. He worked in the Department of Primary Industry in Queensland. He was a Christian, and he wanted to go along to one of these creationist meetings to put these blokes right, because they're obviously talking nonsense. So he came along. Interesting story, ended up being one of our speakers for quite a number of years. But he was interviewed on the DVD, Evolution's Achilles Heels, and listened to a professional biologist.
The first time that I saw a creation presentation on natural selection, I was just amazed at my blindness prior to that, in not realizing that natural selection can only operate on whatever is existing, and it can only operate to remove what is existing. And so the realization that it doesn't actually produce new genetic information was an absolute bombshell to me.
So there you go, never occurred to him. But if you think about it, selection selects, which means it must leave some behind, right? Natural selection does not support evolution. And yet in the biology courses, it's presented evolution is natural selection. You know, they're synonymous. No, they are not. Don't fall for that. So natural selection is not a mechanism for increasing genetic information. So more lately, the neo-Darwinists have come up with the idea of mutations. Now, a mutation is a copying mistake in the coded instructions for making an organism. And if that random copying mistake happens to lead to some beneficial trait, then the story goes that it will become embedded in the population and that change will then become permanent. So you have mutations acted on by natural selection. That's how you go from simple to complex. But mutations can't really help. And let me share a quote from Carl Sagan, who was a very high-profile and outspoken anti-Christian and evolutionist. Mutations occur at random and are almost always, or uniformly, harmful. It is rare that a precision machine is improved by a random change in the instructions for making it. Now, I can tell you, without a shadow of a doubt, if you made random changes to the instructions for assembling a communication spacecraft, you would not get a better product out the door. Now, we all know that intuitively. I mean, it's instinctively obvious, isn't it? You can't just mess with the instructions and hope it's going to get better. You see, mutations are copying mistakes. So if I were to take this sentence and carelessly copy it, make some errors, have I added information? Well, of course not. Errors almost always delete or corrupt information. So random copying errors cannot account for the encyclopedic quantities, not just little bits, remember, encyclopedic quantities of novel genetic information needed in the DNA to go from simple to complex. Simply doesn't work. It works the opposite direction. Things break down. So here's a little rooster which has had a mutation in its DNA which has switched off the process of making feathers. Now, if you happen to be the chook farmer, you'd think this was brilliant because now you don't have to pluck the chooks, right? But I think if you're the little chook, you'd have a different view because now you're going to be very cold in winter and get sunburned in summer, right? But the point here is that there is nothing new. There's just a deletion of what was there before. Now, interestingly, it's called the TNR mutant. That's a technical term, and it means totally naked rooster. It actually does. Scientists are not that creative, you know. They'd probably be in music groups if they were. Anyway, now, some good examples of mutations, messing things up. That's a strawberry kind of deformed and mangled, and this poor calf, as you can see, has got a random pair of legs which is growing out of its back. Mutations do not add valuable traits and so on into living organisms. There is no evidence that that is what happens. However, you can have a beneficial mutation. Now, there is a distinction here. I'm not saying that mutations aren't beneficial, because they can be. Classic example is a little beetle on a windy island. Now, we find populations of these without wings because there's been a mutation, the wings don't form, so the little beetle crawls around on the ground. He doesn't fly. If he flew, he'd be blown off the island and drowned in the sea. But his cousins on the mainland can all fly. So that's a beneficial mutation, but it's still a loss of information. But it does mean at least he can survive. So, mutations don't help. They don't get us from simple to complex. So, does anybody know what the third proposed method is by which random processes can lead to evolution's onward, upward march? Anyone studied biology? Anyone? There isn't one. There is no proposed mechanism. They've got no idea. The secular world cannot explain this, other than that the trying to smudge the issue. Here's an interesting quotation well, not a quotation, an extract from an interview. Now, Professor Richard Dawkins is probably the most, I don't know, contemporary, outspoken advocate for evolution and anti-Christian. And in this particular DVD called From a Frog to a Prince, he was asked, Professor Dawkins, can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome? Now, it's very interesting to see how he responds to that question.
Professor Dawkins, can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome?
I think that silence is very eloquent. You see, if it was true, surely he'd have a cupboard full of examples that he could just pull out and say, look, yeah, it happens like this. He was unable to answer. In fact, it was worse than that. It went on for about 20 seconds. He then asked for the cameras to be stopped and collected his thoughts, and then he came back on camera and answered a question other than what was asked. And you can see the whole of that, and the transcript of that interview is on our website. Dawkins was asked, has evolution been observed? And his reply was, well, evolution has been observed, it's just that it hasn't been observed while it's happening. I'll let you think about that. Not a very good answer, is it? But in fairness to Dawkins, what he means is the processes are so slow that you don't see it in your lifetime. That's what he's trying to say. But that's not even true either. There's no limit to the number of examples of rapid change through natural selection to an organism. Classic example on one of the Hawaiian islands, there's a little cricket which is unable to chirp. And the reason it can't chirp is that there's a predator that hears the chirp, finds the cricket and eats it. And then a mutation arises, random change, and little cricket can't chirp, so he survives. He finds another cricket that can't chirp, of the appropriate sex, and so they reproduce, and the island is now covered in little crickets that can't chirp. But this same cricket over on the mainland or in larger islands chirp annoyingly all the time. And that transformation took place very quickly. The science community was amazed how rapidly it happened. Professor Paul Davies, who's an Australian scientist, sums that up very well. There is no known law of physics able to create information from nothing. You see, we need a whole new law of physics to be able to solve this problem. So, information, specified complexity, a dead giveaway that something has been designed. The second one I want to touch on is having the correct components. Now, when you design and construct a communication satellite, usually the company is the prime contractor, will issue subcontracts to various organisations. They'll make various bits. A lot of it is made in-house. That's the framework, the bus as it's called, of the spacecraft. Here's the antenna platform, which is being mated onto a plate, which then goes onto the bus. So you get all the right bits and you assemble them. So it was believed that we could account for the component parts of a living organism through random processes. And a very famous experiment was done back in 1953 by Miller and Urey. And in it, they constructed an apparatus, which you can see there on the right-hand side, which claimed to reproduce the early Earth's conditions. And so in it, it had an atmosphere that consisted of methane, ammonia, and hydrogen. And there were these lightning flashes or simulated lightning in this chamber up here. And they were trying to make amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, which in turn leads to cells and therefore living organisms. Now, they had no oxygen in their atmosphere because they believed there was no oxygen in the early Earth. The problem is, if there had been oxygen, then that would have prevented the chemical reactions for producing amino acids. And if any did form, they would be destroyed. The trouble is, if there was no oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere, it would mean there's no ozone layer. No ozone layer means that there's no protection from ultraviolet radiation. And you know what ultraviolet radiation does? It destroys amino acids. So you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. Nowadays, of course, people say, oh, no, there must have been oxygen in the early Earth's atmosphere. Not only that, they needed a very special trap to try and extract the amino acids. Well, did it actually work? Well, it sort of did, but not really. They produced very tiny amounts, just a couple of percent of amino acids, and a lot of other toxic organic compounds. But so it was very contaminated, but importantly, the mixture was what's called racemic. That is, it had an equal number of right-handed amino acids and left-handed amino acids. Now, right and left-handedness is something that is possible within the chemical structure of amino acids. They can be one or the other, and a naturally occurring process will produce roughly equal numbers of right and left-handed amino acids. But there's an amazing thing that scientists have discovered. Living cells only have left-handed amino acids. And at the moment you put a right-handed one in there, it completely stops the whole process of making the protein. Grinds to a halt. So let's say you have a protein that consists of, I don't know, a small one, 300 amino acids. So you're chugging away, getting all these left-handed amino acids, and all of a sudden a right-handed one comes. So it's like trying to toss a coin and get 300 heads in a row. Now, instinctively, we all know that that's not going to happen by chance. But the cell is able to reproduce itself. And the way biology textbooks describe this is something like this. Here you have the DNA code, and there's a machine called an RNA polymerase, which transcribes the code into messenger RNA, which then translates it into three letters at a time into amino acids, arranges all amino acids in a row, and that is what forms the protein, and that happens through a mechanism called the ribosome and transfer RNA. So now you know how it works. I hope you're all happy with that. You ready to pass the exam? It's meaningless, isn't it? I mean, that stuff is so complex. But there's help. And the help is that using electron microscopes and other really fancy technology, we can actually see what happens inside the cell and look at the actual molecules themselves. And it's absolutely amazing. Now, I'm going to play you a clip of protein synthesis inside a cell. That is going from the DNA to the protein and the steps in between. You don't have to understand all this, but I just want to give you a flavour for the extraordinary complexity.
One of the most amazing information transfer systems in a cell involves the way proteins are encoded in and decoded from strands of DNA. Starting out with these long, fragile, sticky strings of DNA, an amazing machine called an RNA polymerase zips down the strand, opens up the coils, and copies the DNA into another molecule called RNA. An RNA uses a slightly different language convention. It still has four letters like DNA, but instead of A, C, G, and T, it has A, C, G, and U. The RNA then leaves the nucleus, and another amazing machine attaches to it. It's called a ribosome, and it is in charge of translating from the language of the RNA with its four letter bases to the language of proteins with their 20 different amino acids. Three bases in the bottom of the tRNA match to three letter groups in the RNA. On the other end are amino acids, which pop off as they're attached to the growing protein strand. But the process isn't finished because most proteins need help folding properly. And that's facilitated by little molecules called chaperones. They attach to and protect the unfolded protein as it's transported to a watermelon-shaped molecule called a chaperonin, which folds the protein into its final form. From DNA to protein is an incredibly complex process that uses precise and complex machines to translate between two completely unrelated languages, the linear code of the DNA world to the three-dimensional code of the protein world.
So from the coded instructions on the DNA to that complex shaped protein. And the shape of the protein is enormously important because that then has to fit into a bone or a liver or part of an eye or something. And if the shape is not correct, then it won't fit. And that's the cause of many diseases and malfunctions in living organisms. But how amazing a process is that? That's happening inside every single cell, and your cells self-replicate. So they make all their own machines for making the machines. I mean, it's just extraordinary. Vicious circles in there, closed loops, which you can't get into unless it is all created at the same time. In fact, Professor Sir Fred Hoyle, who is not a Christian but a very astute scientist, said, "The probability of the formation of just one of the many proteins on which life depends is comparable to that of, now get this, the solar system packed full of blind people randomly shuffling Rubik's cubes and all arriving at the solution at the same time." I mean, who in their right mind would accept that as a plausible mechanism? That's to make one protein, one, not to mention the thousands that are needed. Can you imagine what it would look like? With apologies to Ray Charles. I mean, it's just not going to happen, is it? So we know instinctively that random processes cannot produce such complexity. In fact, the law of biogenesis was formulated by Louis Pasteur back in the middle 1800s and basically says that life only originates from life. Well, what do we observe in science? Remember this morning I talked about science being based on observations, not storytelling. Observations. So do we observe life coming from life? You betcha. Humans have babies, dogs have puppies, cats have kittens, all right? We don't get any of this mixing happen. In Genesis chapter 1, 10 times God says things will reproduce according to their kinds. All right? Not to be confused with species, right? There is a difference. So what we observe is exactly consistent with God's word. So here's George Wald, who received a Nobel Prize. Very smart guy. He says, "One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that the spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible." Isn't that amazing? At last he gets it. It's actually impossible. But his belief system overrides. And what does he say? "Yet, here we are as a result, I believe, of spontaneous generation." But he's just said it's impossible. So he's just believed the impossible. Why? Because he refuses to acknowledge the possibility of a creator God. You see, it's a spiritual issue that we're talking about. It's not really about science at all. The debate is acted out in the arena of science, but it's not science. Science is the cover. Remember, atheism dressed up in a lab coat. You get rid of the garb, and what you discover is raw atheistic religion. Belief. That people cling to. Why do they cling to it? Because they don't want there to be a God. Well, I'm reminded of Romans 1:22, where it says, "Professing to be wise, they became fools." So we've got information is a dead giveaway for things designed, the correct components. But then you have to organise the components. If you've got a bench full of bits, it doesn't just magically assemble itself. In fact, the assembly process requires intelligence. So we have to organise it. Now, I want to show you an experiment which I recommend to the young people that you do not do this experiment. All right? You can just observe the concept, but don't do it. Now, imagine that a frog jumps into a blender. So we've got frog soup. Now in the frog soup, we have all the DNA, messenger RNA, the amino acids, the proteins, everything we need to make a frog. So how long will we have to wait before a frog jumps back out of the blender? That's not going to happen, is it? Right, you've got all the bits, but how do you assemble it? In fact, Fred Hoyle again. "The chance that higher life forms might have emerged in this way, that is through a chance assemblage of chemicals, is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the material therein." So can you imagine that? A tornado sweep through a junkyard, all the bits fall down and bang, we've got a working 747. Once again, bizarre. You can have all the bits, but you have to assemble the bits and that requires intelligence. Now, there's a concept that I think is very important to get a hold of in this, because the argument comes back. So, oh yeah, but if you have enough time, time is the hero, you see. with enough time, anything is possible. So if you just wait long enough, surely it's going to happen. Well, the thing which actually stops that is a concept called irreducible complexity. And let me illustrate it like this. Here we have an irreducibly complex machine. It's a mouse trap. It's got a handful of basic component parts, and it all works together. But if you take away any one component, then it won't work. All right, now I'm going to reassemble this. There's all the bits, and if I put it together, there's a bit missing. What's missing from my mousetrap? The little locking arm, right? Yeah. So if you tried to use that mousetrap, what would you get? Fat, happy mice. Or sore fingers, yes, that's right. You see, it has to be complete in every respect before it's of any use whatsoever. And that's exactly the same with biological systems. Can you imagine a partly formed leg? How would that be useful to the creature? In fact, it would be an impediment, this thing hanging off the side. It would make it less able to escape a predator, for instance, or a partly formed eye. What use is that? The whole thing has to be complete all at once, irreducible complexity. So Darwin was aware of this. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And he's exactly right. He went on to say, but I can't think of any. But we can now. There's any number. In fact, almost any biological system is irreducibly complex. It's got multiple bits which must all be together at once, otherwise it simply doesn't work. Now, the classic example is so often used is the bacterial flagellum. Some bacteria have to be able to move, and so they have this little whip-like structure which propels them along. Now, the flagellum consists of some 40 different types of parts. 30 of them appear nowhere else than in the flagellum. And it's like a little outboard motor. So imagine this is the outer boundary of the bacterium. So this is like an outboard motor. It drives up through this shaft, and then you have this whip-like structure, and it zooms around, and as it turns, this thing produces this wave-like oscillatory motion. That is an irreducibly complex structure. It's useless to the bacterium unless it's all there and working. But what's even more stunning is how the flagellum is made. Now, it's all made from within the cell by reading the instructions on the DNA. I want to run this little animation here, which gives you some idea of how that construction happens, just to get a flavour of complexity. So here we have the outer membrane of the cell, and these proteins have been manufactured inside the cell, and you're looking there at the component parts of the little outboard motor. And then along comes this special tool, which is used to puncture through the outer layer of the cell, but it does so without killing the cell. That's the important part. There's the stator of the electric motor. So it punches through and then seals it all off. Now, if it punches through and doesn't seal it, then it kills the bacterium. Then you have these little bits that are made, once again, inside the cell, comes up through the centre of this thing, and a little tool appears in a minute. It's got five sides to it, and the flagellum is actually a hexagon. So as it assembles the flagellum, it has this rotating effect as it goes along. You'll see each of these are individual proteins, and as they're manufactured, they're passed up. You know, this is pretty complex stuff, right? All happening under program control in the DNA. So it busily builds this along. We'll just watch it there for a minute. And then when it's done that, you'll see the others joining with it, and this little bacterium is now able to propel itself along by these flagella. And these are just like little outboard motors. So they have wheels in them. Way back in the 1940s, the famous evolutionist J.B.S. Haldane said, evolution could never produce various mechanisms such as the wheel and the magnet, which would be useless until fairly perfect. Wow. Well, he's right. Evolution can't produce wheels, but they're there. So that says to me, logically, evolution is falsified. So I like this cartoon. Here's the professor with his laboratory and all this complicated equipment, all the equations on the board, and he thinks to himself, if I can just synthesize life here, then I'll have proven that no intelligence was necessary to form it in the beginning. Wow, how bizarre. So, on a communication spacecraft, there's evidence for information, the correct components, and it's all correctly assembled. But you know what? The communication spacecraft is nowhere near as complex as the monarch butterfly or any living self-replicating organism. They have all of the same features, and yet we are told they can only come about by accident. You know, everything we see in the world around us testifies that we are designed for a purpose. Ephesians 2:10 says, "For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works which God prepared in advance for us to do." So what works? You know, the disciples once asked Jesus, "What must we do to do the works that God requires?" And Jesus' answer is profound, isn't it? The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent. See, it's not up to our efforts, is it? We can't work our way to salvation. But we, by faith, which faith, by the way, is a gift from God in the first place, choose to believe who Jesus said he is. That is the work that God requires of us. So right believing actually leads then to right thinking and to right living. So I began with this scripture. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. We hear so much about how there's vast, irrefutable volumes of evidence for the evolutionary story. But friends, when you peel the layers back, it just evaporates. It's not real. What it's about is a religion of atheism being foisted onto our society, onto our young people in particular, under the guise of science. So how do we demolish the argument? Well, we mentioned this morning about Creation Magazine. Quite a few of you have signed up for that. I really encourage you to do that. It's a fabulous resource. Just go over to the tables, make sure you get that form and fill it out. The Answers book, we sold quite a few of those. We've still got some left. Fantastic resource, like a mini library, as I said this morning. The stacks of little booklets over there. This one, Stones and Bones, is a classic. Looks at the evidence in geology and in the fossil record, all of which points to the truth of the Bible's record of history, in particular the flood. The video clips that I've been showing you have all come from Evolution's Achilles Heels, the book which was written by 9 PhD scientists, which set out to look at the main pillars of evolutionary belief, and we show them to be Achilles' heels, that is actually weaknesses. I had the privilege of being one of the contributing authors to that book, and there's a companion DVD which follows the same chapter structure, so you can look at that as 8 separate sections, if you will. A lot of people do that in a study group situation. And as I mentioned this morning, all of those videos from CMI are available now streaming off our website, which has that very difficult web address, creation.com. I want to finish with quoting David Attenborough. I'm sure you will all have seen those amazing BBC programs with the stunning photography that, you know, I look at them and think, oh, praise God, how awesome is his creation. And then poor old David comes on and mumbles things about millions of years. But if you just took his script away and just looked at them, they are just celebrations of God's magnificence as a creator. So he was asked the question, why don't you give credit to Almighty God? Almighty God. And he said, when creationists talk about God creating, they always instance hummingbirds or orchids, sunflowers and beautiful things. But I tend to think instead of a parasitic worm that is boring through the eye of a boy sitting on the bank of a river in West Africa, a worm that's going to make him blind. And I asked them, are you telling me that the God you believe in, who you also say is an all-merciful God who cares for each one of us individually, are you saying that God created this worm that can live in no other way than in an innocent child's eyeball? because that doesn't seem to me to coincide with a God who's full of mercy. And you know what? He's right. You see, he just looks at the world. He sees amazing design and beauty, but he sees suffering and death. So if God created the world like this, what kind of God is he? Did he create us to watch us live, suffer, and then die? Really? I wouldn't want to have anything to do with a God like that. That's why Attenborough rejects God, but he's got completely the wrong understanding of history. That's what I was trying to share this morning. It's the big picture of the Bible. God didn't create the world a mess. He created an original perfect creation that was very good, into which has come the intrusion of death, disease, and suffering. Why? Friends, because of our sin. Yes, it was Adam's, but we are all born under the curse of original sin. Every single one of us is subject to death because of sin. But Jesus has done all that could possibly be done about the problem without withdrawing his mandate of having created us in his image and having given us dominion. He paid the price for our sin so that we can now, today, live in relationship with him through the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit. And we know there is coming a new heaven and a new earth, which will be a restoration of the original creation, only this time without the possibility of sin. But you see, if we allow millions of years into our thinking, it's like taking that top left-hand corner out of the picture. But can you see what's happened now? Now we're saying God created the world full of death, disease, and suffering. This is a problem Attenborough's got, you see. He thinks God made the world like it is, but he didn't, because Attenborough rejects the Genesis account of creation. Now, if the new earth is going to be a restoration to what? Millions of years of more suffering, death, and disease? You see, there's actually no hope for the future, is there? All we've got is this decaying, rotting earth. Friends, can you see how important it is that we get the top left-hand corner back into our thinking? And that's what we read about in those opening chapters of Genesis. So thank you very much for that. I've pretty much covered what I wanted to this afternoon, but I'll be happy to take any questions that if anyone's got any that if I can answer, I will. So has anyone got any questions you'd like to raise of things that we covered this morning, or perhaps any other aspect of this whole debate? Any questions? You're all full bottle now on this. So perhaps I could ask you some questions. Oh, there's one here. Yes, sir.
I want to go back to something you spoke about this morning. And it's just talking about Genesis and Abraham and the fall of Adam and Eve. And we look at Abraham at 2008, I think it was the date you put in there. And I'm just intrigued because when I first became a Christian, I was taught the business about the dispensational ages of as representing the 7 days of creation and 6th day God rested. And I was just thinking the 2,000 years, you take the time from creation to Abraham being 2,000, Abraham to coming of Christ 2,000, and the second coming of Christ to the next 2,000. And it just strikes me how incredibly close we are to the culmination of this 2000. Have you got any thoughts on that one?
I would say simply amen to that. We often get asked questions about the second coming and so on, which is all eschatology. And I often like to point out that I deal primarily with the other end of the book. And the thing with eschatology is we're talking about things which have yet to happen. So there's always an element of uncertainty, except we know that Jesus is coming again. That's absolutely certain. Timings and all of that, we don't go there. But we know he's got it all in his hands. But I am very aware of what you've just drawn our attention to. And a lot of theologians believe there'll be a millennial reign, which you could argue is the 7,000th year of Earth history. And if all of that is indeed true, it can't be very far away. And you look at the events that are happening in the world today, And it's not hard to believe that it's coming close. Just one thing. Sometimes people will say, various astronomical things and signs are happening in the heavens. You read in Genesis 1, and God says that he made the sun, moon and stars to serve as signs and for seasons. All right, now that says to me that we should reasonably expect to see evidence of things that are going to happen in the heavens. And in fact, that's traditionally been the view that scholars have had for many years. But then others will say, yeah, but hang on a minute, all the astronomical things are cyclical. So you might say, well, we've had this conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn back in March. You know, it was an amazing, I hope you might have seen it. It was really quite an extraordinary sight. And so you think, you know, what do these things mean? But if you wind the clock back enough, a few hundred years, you'll find it happened again. And so they're all cyclic, so I don't, you know, the signs in the heavens don't mean anything. But, and this is the big but, in 1948, there was a very important event, apart from my birth, but Israel became a nation. So suddenly the backdrop of the stage is totally different. And those Old Testament prophecies are now being fulfilled right in front of our eyes. So now when you see unusual things happening in the heavens, I think there's every good reason to look forward to the imminent return of Christ. So I don't want to go any more than that because I've got the wrong hat on. But thank you for that. Yeah. Yes.
I don't know all the research and everything, and I don't know what evidence there is, but I've heard lots of people talk about fossils of Neanderthals and previous, if you follow that train of thinking, previous versions of the human. How much evidence is there on that? And if there is, do those fossils follow the same sort of patterns that you talked about this morning about dinosaur patterns and fish patterns in those fossils?
Well, a couple of parts to that. Let me just touch on Neanderthals. They were originally thought of as some kind of a member of the sequence from apes to humans, and they fitted in there somewhere. So they were considered subhuman. A lot of them actually had bone disease. They were sort of stooped like that, and there's possibly good reasons for that. But the more research that's been done on Neanderthals, now even the secularists recognise that they were people. They made cosmetics, they made musical instruments, which were tuned to pentatonic scales. They had religious observances. They were actually very intelligent, and so they were just people. And I didn't get to cover this morning the Tower of Babel, which occurred after the flood, and that would have been the point at which people were spread out over the face of the earth. Neanderthals are likely a group of people who went, they possibly had fair skin, went into northern European countries where they didn't get enough vitamin D and actually had a lot of bone disease like rickets. But nonetheless, they were a group of people, they were human beings. And lately, people have been discovering that there are DNA sequences in modern humans that are identical with Neanderthals. So they say, oh, the Neanderthals interbred with the humans of the day, you know. Maybe they were humans. So I think the evidence is very strong that they were just a people group, and from a biblical perspective, I would place them post-Babel. Now, when you're looking at all this data with evolutionary eyes, people are trying to fit them into the imagined sequence, which has come from apes to humans. There's lots of material. If you go to the website and just type in Neanderthals, you'll find bucket loads of stuff. There's one particularly good talk that was given by Don Batten. It's called Artistic Ape Anecdotes. And he basically looks at all the candidates for human ancestors. And on analysis, they all turn out to be either extinct apes or human beings. There's just nothing in the middle. There are no transitional forms at all. That's why even the slightest hint of a transitional form hits the headlines. They think, wow, we've at last found one. Whoops, no, it's not. It's really over there. There's nothing. And yet the textbooks continue to display that classic image of the crouched ape and sort of, you know, the bloke standing up, and finally you have Homo sapiens, us. But it's without any foundation. And the annoying thing is that the secularists know that it's without foundation. It's an illusion. I have a quote that probably can't find quickly enough from a guy called Bernard Wood, who's one of the world's leading paleontologists and expert in human evolution. And he says it's an illusion. He actually admits it. And yet it's faithfully reproduced in textbook after textbook. God made every living organism to reproduce after their own kinds. Human being is a kind. Humans produce humans. Never anything else. Thanks. Any others? Someone over there? Yes.
If God watches over all of the universe, then doesn't that mean that there should be no supersymmetrical particle?
No. What was the last bit?
Supersymmetrical.
Supersymmetrical particles. Look, there's a lot of research now into quantum mechanics. Things like the Large Hadron Collider is an amazing scientific instrument that's trying to break down the atom into all of its subatomic particles, so we learn more and more and more. And interestingly, the deeper scientists go into those things, the more perplexing and bewildering the structure of the atom becomes. And so there's all kinds of theories. Supersymmetry is one of them. There's lots about trying to explain how the atom works, how it exists. But people actually don't really know. There are quite counterintuitive things that appear to happen in quantum mechanics. Action at a distance, for instance, is one of those. So I'm not a quantum mechanics expert, but if you go onto our website, type in some keywords into the search window, you're most likely to find some really good articles. One of our speakers is a nuclear physicist based in Canada, Dr. Jim Mason. He's got articles on the subatomic particles in atoms and what has actually been found and not. Some people, you might remember a little while ago, though, people were very concerned about the Large Hadron Collider, that it was going to recreate the Big Bang. And people thought, oh my goodness, they're going to wipe out the planet. Which, you know, of course, didn't happen and is actually nonsense. But I love the results that these scientific experiments produce, because everything that is found from observable science, correctly interpreted, supports the Bible. And it's constant. And you see the headlines, people say, scientists are perplexed. And they say things like, we have to rethink our whole understanding of something or other. You'd think after a while they would begin to wonder, why are we always perplexed with the results? Why is it always different from what we expect? Could be that they're starting from the wrong basic assumption. And if they took the word of God as truth, then they might expect to see what they actually get. But yeah, good question, thank you. Any others? One there?
Thanks for today, Mark. It's been very good. My question is regarding current times, and you know, we're in this pandemic. The good Lord gave us an immune system to protect us. We're now being led to believe that we need a miracle cure injected into us to further protect us. Where do you stand with all of this? And you know, as a Christian, you know, I sort of feel it's a conditioning process for times to come, you know, to have things injected in us for our own good. So where do we go from here?
So a good question about the, there are lots of questions about COVID-19, and then onto vaccination. So if you look on our website, you'll find there are several articles that came out last year, actually, looking at what COVID-19 actually is, the kind of virus that it is, where it may in fact have come from. It's one of those very cloudy issues concerning its origin, because as you can imagine, there's an enormous amount of political sensitivity about how it came about and then how it came to spread around the world so quickly, and whether certain organisations should have responded more quickly or not, etc. So I don't want to get into all of that. But vaccinations are one of the ways in which we can implement the dominion mandate. You see, God has given us the ability to understand how things work. So a lot of medical science is all about finding effective ways to cure diseases. And so with the technologies we have today, it's remarkable. I, for instance, have several stents in my heart. Back in 2008, I probably would have died, but for the intervention of cardiologists and some incredible technology where they inserted these things into my heart. I collect them. I've got five, by the way. I don't know if anybody's got more than that, but I'm pretty proud of my stents, just as long as they keep working. So what we see is it's like mankind exercising the dominion mandate. Now, vaccinations have done extraordinary good. You look at, when I was growing up, there was a couple of kids in my primary school who had polio. They had leg braces on, and it was a terrible disease. But through vaccination, that's been effectively eradicated. And what the vaccination does is it stimulates that brilliantly designed immune system to recognise the poliomyelitis cells and what have you that are in the body and attack them. So it teaches the immune system how to operate. Now, then by a vaccination program, you have a whole population now who are effectively immune to the disease and it disappears. Smallpox is another one. Hideous disease. It used to kill children. Vaccinations, by the way, have several articles on vaccinations on the website. Now, there's a lot of misinformation that flies around about vaccinations. And you have to be very careful of the source of your information, and not only the source, but also the facts that are used to persuade people of the argument being made, and go and examine them. One of them, for instance, is to do with the claim that aborted fetuses are used to produce the cell lines to manufacture the vaccines. And you'll see one of our articles on the website drills into that issue. It turns out that way back in the, I think, 1970s, there was a cell line taken from an aborted baby, but the baby was not aborted to produce the cell line. It was a, if you like, an incidental benefit from that terrible thing. So it was a sinful act. But by using that, they were to cultivate that, and they propagate it, and it is used in certain vaccines. But it's not as though we're out there aborting babies to produce vaccines to cure diseases. That would be absolutely, totally immoral. It's nothing like that at all. It's a bit, you could think of it a bit like this. If you had a kidney disease and you needed a transplant because you're going to die, somebody gets killed in a car accident because it was a drunk driver who went through a red light, and that person from their body, the kidney's taken and transplanted into you because it happens to be a match, and you now live. Now, should you reject that kidney and say, no, I won't have it because it came from a sinful act? Well, no. There's no moral accountability upon you regarding that kidney. So the same logic applies to this issue. So just be very careful. Vaccinations are, I think, an example of mankind using the dominion mandate to ameliorate the effects of the curse. Now, you will never totally ameliorate them because we are subject to death because of sin. But God has that new heaven and new earth for which we are all destined. So I direct you to the website to see the articles there. There's several of them. Okay, this question there?
Yes, it's not so much a question, but something just to support what you were saying earlier about the age of the earth, that the Bible gives the impression that it's thousands of years old, whereas evolutionists believe the galaxy is billions of years old. I was very, very encouraged in 69 when Armstrong landed the Apollo on the moon. The evolutionists, scientists believe because it was billions of years old, it was probably about 20 feet of dust on the surface of the moon. So they put extendable arms on it. But when they land on the moon, there wasn't hardly any surface dust. They just didn't have those billions of years of dust build up.
Yeah, now that's an argument that used to be used extensively as an argument for the young age of the moon and therefore the solar system. But unfortunately, there was an error in the estimates of the rate at which dust is accumulating on the moon, which was overstated by a very significant margin. So it wasn't that creationists made the mistake, it was actually the secular scientists, because they were genuinely concerned that when they landed, they'd just sink into millions of years or billions worth of dust accumulation. Turns out it wasn't there, but it's not there because the rate of accumulation is much, much lower than what was first assumed. So we don't actually use that as an evidence for the young age of the moon, because it's not a very clear argument, because the original data was incorrect. It's now been verified by measurement. One of the things that the Apollo missions did was leave behind a number of experiments, and one of them is looking at the rate of dust accumulation on the moon, and that's verifying the extremely low rate, but it's still there, but we don't actually use it. It's it's not a strong argument. By the way, I should just point out, on our website there's an article called Arguments That Creationists Should Not Use. Now, there's quite a lot of them. We hold lightly to the science, but we hold firmly to the scriptures. We hold lightly to science because any day a scientist can come up with an observation that refutes what was previously understood by the scientific community. That's how science works. So science only ever uncertainly approaches truth. Science can reveal absolute error, but it can't reveal absolute truth. So when something turns out, oh, someone's got some more evidence here, well, that argument doesn't work well now, so we discard it. There's plenty others out there, such as I've shared with you today, that are very, very powerful arguments for the creation account in the Bible. There's one over there.
Might say this is the last one, Mark.
I think I might make it the last one, because I've got an aeroplane to catch.
I just have a question regarding when there's discoveries or fossils or whatever found, and we're told on the news and to everybody that this is so many millions or billions of years of age and proven by carbon dating. Where's the fallibility of this carbon dating that just tells everyone, well, there's the proof?
Okay, that's a very good question. I should point out that there is actually a chapter in the Answers book that deals with carbon dating and radiometric dating in general. Just hoping I can find an illustration to help with that. But the first comment to make is that carbon dating never produces millions of years. Carbon dating is only able to operate in the realms of, if we could have the video up please, it only works for about 60 or 70,000 years. Carbon dating relies on a radioactively unstable form of carbon called carbon-14, and that decays very rapidly. So if someone tells you it's been carbon dated to millions of years, then they don't understand actually what they're talking about, because it's not true. So just quickly, the way radioisotope working dating works is there's some sort of radioactively unstable parent element that decays at a certain rate and produces a daughter element. So if you get a sample like a rock or the bone or something of a fossil, and you measure the ratio of the parent element to the daughter element, you should be able to calculate the age. But the problem is you've got to make a whole stack of assumptions. Now remember, you're doing your science in the present, you're not doing science in the past, and you weren't there to observe the conditions. So one of the assumptions you make is that the parent element has not been added to or subtracted to during its life, and you know what the initial concentration is. So you've got to make three assumptions about the parent element, the same about the daughter element, and in fact, you don't really know that the decay rate has been a constant. So there are seven different assumptions you have to make to be able to calculate an age. So because it's assumption-based, and because, by the way, radiometric dates always scatter, scientists never take a radiometric date on its own. They always test it against other evidences. In geology, it'll be a field evidence from a nearby rock strata, for instance. Or if it's in biology or paleontology, they'll look at where they believe this organism fits in the evolutionary story. So that will bracket the allowable or possible age that it could have. And if the radiometric date falls outside of that, they just reject it. Must be an error, you know. But you can test some rocks of known age to see how good the dating methods are. And the way to get a rock of known age, good way, is to take a where there's been a volcanic eruption and the lava has solidified, then take a sample of that. You know the date of the eruption, you now know the age of the rock. And there's a clock called the potassium argon clock. Argon is an inert gas. It bubbles out of molten lava, but it gets trapped when the rock solidifies. So here's some volcanic eruptions. Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. Rock from the lava dome was dated anywhere from 350,000 to 2.8 million years. But the rock was only 10 years old when the dating was done. Here in Kilauea, which, by the way, was erupting a couple of years ago again, but 200 years ago there was an eruption from that lava flow. The rocks were dated anywhere from 0 to 22 million years. But it's only 200 years ago the event took place, and another one in Hawaii. So the problem is, if you get incorrect dates for rocks of known age, how can you be sure that you're getting the correct date for a rock of unknown age? And I've got this lovely quotation where a scientist says, "It's notoriously difficult to date young rocks." So have a think about that. You find your rock. Got no idea if it's old or young. You rock up to the laboratory, "Can you date my rock?" And they'll give you a date. By the way, if this is a young rock, then that date's wrong. But if it's an old date, then an old rock rather, the date's probably right. Well, how do you know? It's really quite bizarre. Just a quick one here in Queensland at Crinum Mine. There's a lava flow which has gone over a forest. It's 20 metres down. The wood is still wood and it's charred from the lava. So the wood was carbon dated at 44 to 45,000 years old, but the basalt is 45 million years old. But they must be about the same age because the lava flowed through the forest. So there's all sorts of examples like that, but I do commend to you the Answers book, because there's a great article in there on radiometric dating. So maybe if I just leave it at that, I think that's probably about all I can cover on that topic. So look, folks, thank you very, very much for your attention. Let me encourage you again, we've still got the materials available. If you haven't got the magazine, I do encourage you to get it. It's a great resource and great for giving away. Don't keep them. A lot of people collect them, hate that. Take the magazines, when you've read it, give it to someone. You never know, they might come into the kingdom as a result. But get equipped so you can give an answer to all those who ask you for the reason for the hope that you have. So bless you. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks.